From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, train station attack in China raises terror fears. Pakistan's prime minister defends Taliban peace talks despite concerns from rights groups. World health officials say polio vaccine mandatory for departing Pakistanis. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Chinese state media say six people were wounded Tuesday in a knife attack at a train station in a southern city. It's the latest in a series of such attacks. The People's Daily says four knife-wielding men dressed in all white attacked passengers who had just gotten off of a train at Guangzhou Railway Station. The report said police fired at the men, killing one and capturing another. The other two escaped, although some reports say that one was later caught. Officials have not commented on the motive, although the attack bore similarities to others the government has blamed on terrorists from the Xinjiang region. The third attack at a train station in China in a little more than 2 months is sparking fears of terrorism. We have more from Shannon Van Sant in Beijing.
A midday stabbing attack Tuesday left six people injured at a train station in the southern Chinese city of Guangzhou. China's foreign ministry spokesperson Hua Chunying says whoever carried out this attack will be brought to justice. She says the Chinese government will take firm actions to safeguard the lives of the Chinese people. Chinese state-run media reported police gunned down one of the attackers, captured a second, and said two attackers are still at large. A local newspaper reported the attackers were wearing white hats. It is the third attack at a train station in recent weeks. Suicide bombers killed three people and injured 79 others in an attack at a train station in Urumqi, the capital of China's Xinjiang province, last weekend. On March 1st, a group of men and women killed 29 people and injured another 143, slashing people with knives at a train station in the southwestern Chinese city of Kunming. China's government blamed these incidents on terrorists from Xinjiang separatist movements. Last week, China's President Xi Jinping visited Xinjiang province, where he vowed to fight terrorism with an iron hand, implement development to benefit the common people, and strengthen military presence in the region. Beijing Foreign Studies University visiting Professor James Liebold says the attacks are embarrassing for the Chinese leadership.
And then you have this attack at the train station, which clearly was meant to send a signal to Xi in the state that at least some Uyghurs, at least the two attackers in the case of Urumqi, didn't buy into his vision of a so-called China dream.
The latest attack occurred in one of China's largest cities and transportation hubs. Photos broadcast on CCTV showed paramedics treating people in the large public square of the Guangzhou Railway Station. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
Still to come on Daybreak Asia, we explore top universities that have been in existence for less than 50 years. Afghan police fired shots into the air Tuesday to disperse villagers demanding aid at the site of a massive landslide in northeastern Afghanistan. Authorities say no one was injured when several people rushed toward a truck carrying emergency supplies to those affected by last week's landslide. Hundreds of people in the village of Abi Barak in Badakhshan province were buried when the side of a mountain collapsed following days of heavy rain. At least 2,000 people have been displaced in one of the worst natural disasters to hit Afghanistan. Officials are struggling to get aid into the remote Argo district. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is continuing to defend his government's efforts to tackle Islamic extremism and militancy through peace talks with the Pakistani Taliban. As Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad, critics say the controversial floundering peace dialogue is instead emboldening Islamic forces in Pakistan, adding to the concerns of religious minorities.
Civil society groups and moderate political forces are opposed to Prime Minister Sharif's policy of engaging the Pakistani Taliban in peace talks. These critics maintain that the outlawed alliance of militant groups has killed tens of thousands of Pakistanis as part of its plan to reject the constitution and impose its brand of Islam through violent means. Even though the dialogue has made little progress since it was launched 2 months ago, Prime Minister Sharif told a gathering of Pakistani diplomats in Islamabad Tuesday that the process still could succeed in ending the deadly militancy.
We hope that our sincere efforts would yield the desired results and help turn the tide of violence, which is preventing our nation from realizing its true potential.
But local and foreign observers have reported alarming deterioration in human rights areas in Pakistan. The U.S. Commission on Religious Freedom in its latest report expressed concern over increasing threats facing minority communities in Pakistan, saying conditions have hit an all-time low. An independent watchdog, Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, in its latest report has said that the human rights situation has not shown any improvements in the past 6 months, adding that more reasons for alarm have surfaced. It has condemned attacks on places of worship belonging to non-Muslims. The commission says that there have been several attacks on Hindu temples, particularly in southern parts of Pakistan. The organization's Secretary General, I.A. Rahman, says that insecurity felt by non-Muslims is reflected in the thousands of people leaving the country at a time when a rise in religious intolerance is compelling many to convert to Islam.
The condition of minorities is getting worse by months. It is now impossible, nearly impossible, for a blasphemy accused to have a trial in Pakistan. They can't have lawyers, they can't have safety, they can't have protection. So this is becoming a very grave issue.
Pakistani law criminalizes blasphemy against Islam, the majority religion in the country. Critics say the law has been abused in recent years to target religious minorities. Rahman says that the rise in religious intolerance under the Sharif government is a matter of grave concern for civil society activists in Pakistan.
The policies that are being followed are also creating problems. We are all for peace, you know, but we want to know on what condition peace is being brought from the Taliban. Like many other civil society organizations, we are full of apprehension that the only concession that the state can give will be at the cost of women and minorities.
Pakistani security forces have conducted repeated offensives against militant groups entrenched in the country's northwestern tribal areas, but have not been able to uproot their bases. There have been peace talks and deals with militants previously, but critics insist they have only allowed extremist groups time to regroup. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The World Health Organization has slapped travel restrictions on Pakistan, Cameroon, and Syria in an effort to control the spread of the crippling polio virus. Sharon Bain reports from Islamabad that Pakistan is moving quickly to make polio vaccines mandatory for all those planning to travel out of the country.
On Monday, the World Health Organization announced Pakistan, Cameroon, and Syria should ensure all residents and long-term visitors get a polio vaccination prior to international travel. WHO's Assistant Director General Bruce Aylward said the polio virus had been found widely circulating in other countries in 2013. Pakistan has the highest incidence of polio in the world, and the virus has been found in sewage water in Israel, Egypt, and West Bank Gaza, as well as in Iraq and Syria. Pakistan Minister of National Health Services Saira Afzal Tahrir told VOA the government is putting an immunization plan in place.
We are concerned about our international responsibility regarding the spread of polio, and we were already considering that along with our provincial government that we should make sure that all Pakistani before leaving Pakistan, they should have these polio drops.
The WHO is recommending anyone traveling out of Pakistan should be vaccinated 4 weeks to 12 months prior to travel and provide proof of inoculation. Pakistan, Nigeria, and Afghanistan are the three remaining countries in which the virus remains endemic. Because of a Taliban ban on vaccinations and its deadly attacks on anti-polio health teams, national eradication efforts in Pakistan have suffered critical setbacks, and the virus continues to spread. Tahrir said those areas inaccessible to health workers are the main reservoirs of the polio virus. A heavy Taliban presence has all but denied access to the tribal area of North Waziristan. Pakistan's prime minister has asked the country's military to help protect polio vaccination workers in the insurgency-plagued northwest. Although not legally binding, the WHO recommendation carries a lot of weight, says the organization's acting representative in Pakistan, Nima Sayed Abid.
Expectation that many countries will implement, but it depends on the member state to implement. I don't think member states would ignore these recommendations.
The World Health Organization said the spread of poliovirus is a public health emergency of international concern. The travel measures announced Monday are expected to remain in place until 6 months have passed without poliovirus exportations. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
Vietnamese police have arrested two activists for posting online material that is critical of the country's communist government. In a statement, the Ministry of Public Security said Nguyen Hu Vinh and Nguyen Thai Minh were arrested Monday in the capital, Hanoi. They are accused of abusing democratic freedoms by posting content that reduces prestige and trust in state agencies. They each face up to 7 years in prison if found guilty of the charge. Vinh, an ex-policeman, is the well-known founder of the Bossom blog, which deals with Vietnamese politics, corruption, and foreign policy. The website often includes articles questioning government policies and has been targeted repeatedly by hackers. This is the latest crackdown on free speech and dissent in Vietnam, where all newspapers and television channels are state-run. South Korea next month could become the first developed country to be banned from selling its seafood to Europe. This comes amid an unprecedented crackdown led by the European Union on illegal fishing. The issue is also getting more attention in the United States, where a new study contends one-third of its seafood imports are illegally caught or improperly documented. We have details from VOA correspondent Steve Herman in our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Observers say the European Union is poised to hand South Korea a so-called red card next month unless Seoul is able to convince the EU Fisheries Commissioner that it is cracking down on illegal fishing by boats flying its flag. South Korea, along with Ghana and Curaçao last year, was handed a yellow card warning. Continuing violations by South Korean flag ships, many in waters off the coast of West Africa, could bring further sanctions this year. The EU issued its first ever red cards for pirate fishing in March of this year, banning Belize, Cambodia, and Guinea from selling their seafood in EU countries and from fishing in member countries' waters. Steve Trent of the Environmental Justice Foundation, which tracks illegally caught fish heading to EU markets, praises the new tough regulations for Europe.
It's beginning to show its teeth, and that is what is happening with regard to Korea. We are seeing the European Commission saying, you haven't done enough, what you have done doesn't satisfy us, and unless you do more, there will be penalties.
Since 2010, the EJF has documented more than 200 cases of South Korean ships allegedly targeting high-value fish species in waters off West Africa. The organization says South Korean pirates routinely fish in protected areas, flee fisheries patrols, refuse to pay fines, cover their identification markings, transship fish illegally at sea, and attack local fishermen. It says on some of the vessels, workers as young as 14 are forced to live and work at sea in deplorable conditions for months at a time. A new study on illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing looks at seafood entering the United States. It finds 40% of the tuna from Thailand is illegal or unreported. That was also the case with 70% of salmon imports and 45% of pollock, both from China. The lead author of the report is Pramod Ganapati Raju, a researcher at the Fisheries Center at the University of British Columbia. He says the U.S. and other major seafood importing markets, such as the European Union, China, Japan, and South Korea, see most of the product coming in through containers and cargo ships.
The volumes are quite high, but at the same time, the amount of manpower that is needed to make sure that illegal catches don't enter these markets is quite low in most of these importing countries. So they need to increase the manpower to improve monitoring, control, and surveillance at their ports.
A 2009 government report found that only about 2% of seafood imports in the United States were being inspected at the ports. There is no public data for most other major import markets. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Thailand's constitutional court says it will deliver a verdict Wednesday on the abuse of power charges against Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat. The prime minister could be removed from office if found guilty. The charges relate to the 2011 replacement of Ms. Yingluck's then national security chief. Her critics say the move was unconstitutional and meant to benefit her Po Thai party. Separately, Thailand's Anti-Corruption Commission has charged Ms. Yingluck with the dereliction of duty charge over a government rice-buying scheme that critics say is wasteful and corrupt. Ms. Yingluck's supporters say the cases are politically motivated. The opposition protesters say Ms. Yingluck's government is hopelessly corrupt and controlled by her brother, ex-Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, who was removed from office in a 2006 military coup. Ms. Yingluck already called for early elections in February, but the opposition boycotted the vote and disrupted it in many provinces with protests. Last week, the Prime Minister and the Election Commission agreed to hold another election July 20th, but it's unclear if the opposition will participate this time. Thai officials say one person was killed and 23 others injured in the 6.0 magnitude earthquake that hit the northern part of the country on Monday. Officials said Tuesday an 83-year-old woman died when a wall in her home collapsed in the Chiang Rai province near the epicenter of the quake. There was also widespread damage to homes, hospitals, temples, and other buildings in the region near the border with Burma and Laos. The temple known to tourists as the White Temple suffered extensive damage. At another temple, the head fell off of a Buddha statue. The quake and the several large aftershocks that followed was one of the strongest to hit Thailand in recorded history. It struck at a relatively shallow depth of 7.4 kilometers and could be felt as far away as Bangkok and the Burmese city of Rangoon.
Hi, I'm David Byrne.
And I'm Ling Yang.
I'm Aisha Khalid.
And I'm Madeline Ek.
We're the hosts of VOA's Now.
We'll be bringing you stories that interest you.
Join the conversation
every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
Beginning April 28th for the Voice of America's Now.
If someone were to ask you to name the top universities in the world, you might very well include the historic, well-established universities of the Western world, places like Harvard, Yale, Oxford, and Cambridge that come to mind. However, things are changing. Many newer universities are making their mark in the world of elite higher education. The British publication Times Higher Education has been researching schools and issuing lists of the best of them for many a year. One of the publication's newest lists rates universities that have been in existence for fewer than 50 years. Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman spoke with a man in charge of compiling these lists. Phil Beatty is the editor-at-large of Times Higher Education magazine and the editor of the Times Higher Education World University Rankings. He says these emerging schools point to a trend that could eventually lead to some difficulties for the traditional Western institutions.
Well, I don't think it's a real concern for older universities. They're still obviously doing well. They still top the world university rankings, you know, the likes of Harvard and Yale. But I think what it does is it sends out a warning sign. There are many up-and-coming institutions challenging for their crowns. Lots of emerging economies, certainly in East Asia and Southeast Asia, are investing heavily in creating world-class universities specifically designed to compete with the traditional leaders from North America and Western Europe. So I think it's a strong sign that no university can afford to rely on heritage, rely on reputation. And there are real stars emerging and coming to challenge the traditional hierarchies.
And the report says that most of these stars are in East Asia. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes, the top of these rankings are very heavily dominated by East Asia. We have four of the top five positions in the world taken by universities from South Korea, from Singapore, and from Hong Kong. And I think that's really a reflection of the governments of those countries prioritizing investment in world-class universities as a key part of their economic strategies to drive the knowledge economy. And I think that's a political lesson to America and to Western Europe in terms of the fact we've seen austerity leading to the state reducing funding for universities, which seems to be a very short-sighted thing. So I think the balance of power may be slowly turning towards Asia, and you know, Asian universities are really starting to make an impact in these kind of rankings.
You are well aware of the growing numbers of students from East Asia trying to and gaining admission to Western universities, especially in the United States. Does this say to a parent or a student in East Asia that I can get as good or better an education by staying home or in my own region?
Yeah, I mean, we're starting to see a situation where there's more and more circulation within Asia. So students who are willing to travel abroad for their education have traditionally thought, I need to go to America, I need to go to the UK. But actually now there are really powerful forces emerging in Asia. So we're finding a circulation of international students within the Asian region. So China to Hong Kong, Hong Kong to Singapore, Singapore to South Korea. It's a a really interesting change. Of course, America will still continue to dominate international student recruitment. You know, the world's students do still primarily want to choose America and the great universities in America.
Is there a difference in the kind of education someone would get at a newer Eastern Asian university as opposed to the traditional colleges of the United States and UK and Australia?
Well, there's no hard and fast rule, but I think there is a sense that they prioritize the student experience more highly than some of the traditional universities. Some traditional universities are so focused on research, the rewards that come purely from blue skies research means that students are often neglected. They don't get to see the staff professors. You know, they're taught by grad students. And these universities think, like, we have to work harder. We don't have the reputation, the heritage. We have to fight harder for our place. And they're saying we offer a better student experience, more close links with industry, more applied research that will be relevant to the real world. So I think there is a case to be made that some of these universities potentially offer a better experience for students, but that's not obviously a hard and fast rule.
So are you in any way, shape, or form saying that people in East Asia, students in East Asia, should pretty much stay where they are?
I think international study is a fantastic thing. I think the big companies around the world, they're really desiring global citizens. It's very attractive on your resume, on your CV, to say that you have an international outlook, you have intercultural skills. So I recommend study abroad. I think it's a fantastic thing for a student to do. But I would say that it doesn't mean that there's only one or two destinations. The world is your oyster, and there are multiple options. There are actually 29 different nations represented in this top 100 list we've just published. And, you know, there are lots of exciting, dynamic young institutions who are interested in student recruitment, are increasingly seeking international students. And to compete with the big brand names like Harvard or Oxford or Cambridge, they're offering some pretty exciting programs. So I think there are many, many options, and they don't always point to the traditional North American or Western Europe universities.
What does that mean to these U.S., U.K., Western universities, as you know, that those just below the tier of the Harvards and the Stanfords and the Yales are colleges that are looking upon international students to help solve their financial crises that they face? What is this going to mean for them?
I think it means that they have to be absolutely alert to the challenges. They can't coast. They mustn't allow themselves to become complacent. It's a very competitive market for international students, and as you point out, often they rely on international student income to help them survive. So it's going to be a ruthless environment, and I think the key thing is that a lot of these young universities we've been profiling and case studying with this new ranking, they're extremely innovative. They're very dynamic. They've got really close, intimate links with industry, so the students are immersed in the real world of work, and they probably are allowed to take a few more risks as well. So the message really is that relying on past reputation, relying on maybe your heritage, or relying on the city you're based in, won't wash anymore. It's a very competitive world. The market's changing. Complacency is absolutely not an option.
Phil Beatty is the editor-at-large of the Times Higher Education magazine and editor of the Times Higher Education World University Rankings, and was speaking with our own Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman. We happen to think our latest world news is highly ranked. It's up next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.
The Beatles.